civil society pressure for that to happen. So that's where my hope is. It's I'm not putting any optimism that these powerful Western states in the global north are going to change their ways anytime soon.
But here there's been huge, you know, waves because the UK and Canada and Australia and New Zealand and Norway have announced sanctions against Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich for their outrageous statements, genocidal statements. And sanctions have been levied against individual violent settlers by various countries. I mean, even the Biden administration did that, and Canada's done it, and I think the UK has done it. But none of them are actually targeting the entire settlement enterprise. None of them talk about the entire huge settlement enterprise, which is fully and wholly, obviously, state-sponsored, totally institutionalized and systematic, advanced by every single prime minister of Israel since 1967, no one more so than Benjamin Netanyahu. And yet there is a big, you know, foo-fra about these sanctions against Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and a few violent settlers, but it's the entire enterprise that needs to be targeted.
Of course, but it can only be done in terms of actual sanctions by individual prosecutions of these individuals. Once there are serious prosecutions, the ICC arrest warrants against Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant are actually executed, and these people are arrested and put in the dock and put on trial, it is only then that the impunity is going to start to crumble. And so it has to be done piecemeal, because there isn't a way when Israel is completely unwilling and actually thumbing its nose at the decisions of the International Court of Justice, the General Assembly, and of course the International Criminal Court. As long as they defy the global international order, it's going to have to be work within individual states to prosecute, investigate, prosecute, and execute these warrants and issue more warrants.
But aside from criminal arrest warrants, there need to be comprehensive sanctions, because the International Court of Justice opined and the General Assembly adopted it that states should no longer treat Israel's occupation as if it were illegal, and they should simply terminate all aid and assistance to it. They've got to impose comprehensive sanctions on all activities associated with the occupation, like a complete arms embargo on all, block on all arms that are going to be used in the occupied territory, which means the West Bank as well as East Jerusalem as well as Gaza. So forget about a comprehensive arms embargo on Israel's war in Gaza, but there can't be any more supply of weapons that are being used by soldiers in the West Bank.
Of course. And again, here, it's going to be civil society. And we have seen some of these lawsuits from against, like the Netherlands, for its arms trade, against Spain domestically, for it has ended its arms contracts. But this is only because of civil society and because of lawyers within countries suing their own governments for noncompliance. And of course, we have to see much more of that. But all of this takes tremendous effort and it takes resources. It's not an easy task when state governments refuse to comply. It's not an easy task for that burden to fall on civil society to pressure them.
And I appreciated your one of your last recommendations in your report issued on May 15th to the United Nations and human rights bodies. The UN Security Council should authorize the deployment of a peacekeeping force in the occupied Palestinian territory to ensure compliance with the ICJ's advisory opinion requiring an immediate end to Israel's illegal occupation. This would be a Chapter 7 resolution, an enforceable resolution at the Security Council. I mean, in my dreams.
Well, yes, but there is a precedent. So in 1950, The General Assembly passed the Uniting for Peace resolution, which basically says that when there is a breach of peace and the Security Council is at a deadlock and fails to act, the General Assembly has the authority to act. And the General Assembly has used this once in the Suez Crisis in 1956 and authorized peacekeeping forces in Gaza. Those forces stayed there for 10 years and prevented the conflict from being ongoing. Now, of course, the Security Council under Chapter 7 has a much clearer authority. And as I said, this has only been used, to my knowledge, once by the General Assembly. But it doesn't mean it can't be done again, because we now have a track record of a dozen, 10 or a dozen resolutions from the General Assembly calling for a ceasefire, calling for humanitarian aid to go in, calling for an end to the occupation of Gaza, and the Security Council again and again vetoing it. So acting under Uniting for Peace, to my mind, the Suez precedent is an important one, and that this is no longer just within the purview of the Security Council. So I think it can be done, but it is going to take the concerted action of many states, including the Western states that now have clearly voted for a ceasefire. Another option would be for a group of willing states to take an aid armada by sea to break the siege of Gaza. They can do that. Israel is not authorized to patrol international waters around Gaza or the Gazan waters. And an aid flotilla, as was raised actually at the Gaza Tribunal, could together bring the necessary aid and break the siege of Gaza if they were willing to do so.
A couple of dozen military vessels, naval vessels from France, the UK, Turkey, Italy, Greece.
Absolutely, of course.
They could all sail to the
Yes,
Eastern
quite do so.
Mediterranean and end it.
Right, absolutely. They could do it tomorrow. And they would be well within their legal rights, because the ICJ has said this occupation has to end. The ICJ has also issued three provisional orders in the case by South Africa against Israel, that Israel must let all humanitarian aid in. Using starvation as a weapon of war is manifestly criminal and illegal. So states would be fully within their rights to implement the international law themselves.
Last question, Susan Akram. These are scary times. There is no rule of law anymore. The international rule of law, this body of canonical legal instruments and laws and statutes passed since the Second World War, have been hollowed out. They've been shown to be a totally empty shell by Israel and the United States. So it's kind of scary.
Well, so I think our problem is not international law. It is the enforcement, the weakness of the enforcement mechanisms. And one of the basic fundamental problems with the international legal system is the inequitable division of authority under the UN Charter. That is, giving this massive authority to a handful of states at the Security Council, when the majority of the world's population is represented at the General Assembly, and yet the authorization for use of force is exclusively given to the states that can veto, the five veto-holding states at the Security Council, who in essence decide who lives and who dies, and who gets the benefit of international legal protection and who does not. This system has to change before we are going to have meaningful, universal, equitable application of international law.
Susan Akram is clinical professor and director of the International Human Rights Clinic at Boston University School of Law. An analysis of Israel's laws and policies and the responsibilities of U.S. academic and other institutions was released on May 15th, written by Akram. together with Sandra Babcock, Thomas Becker, and James Cavallaro from Cornell and Columbia Law Schools and Yale Jackson School of Global Affairs. We'll link to that report at greenplanetmonitor.net. Playing extracts from a People's Tribunal on the Gaza genocide that took place in Sarajevo at the end of May, inspired by the 1966 Russell Tribunal on the U.S. War on Vietnam and the 2003-2005 World Tribunal on the U.S. War on Iraq. The Gaza Tribunal was launched in London in November 2024, faced with, quote, a total failure of the organized international community to implement international law in the most severe visible case of genocide in real time, unquote, the Gaza Tribunal's website states. It aims to legitimize an alternative paradigm of international law, one that derives its authority from people and their sense of justice, rather than relying solely on governments and their institutions. That was a quote. The Gaza Tribunal is governed by an 8-member steering committee headed by Richard Falk, Emeritus Professor of International Law and former UN Special Rapporteur on Occupied Palestine, assisted by an advisory policy council of civic society leaders and public intellectuals from Palestine, Europe, and North America. The tribunal's final judgment will be rendered by a jury of conscience, composed of a half dozen judges following closed hearings in Istanbul in late October. That judgment, together with personal testimony, civil society submissions, and closing reports from each of the tribunal's three chambers, will be incorporated into a set of public archives that will remain open for continuing submissions. Here's a presentation on the third day of the Gaza Tribunal in Sarajevo. Sari Makhdizi is an American literary critic and professor of Palestinian and Lebanese descent. He also writes on contemporary Arab politics and culture. Makhdizi is professor of English and comparative literature at the University of California, Los Angeles.
The question I'd like to address with you today is the historical and ideological underpinnings of what we call the Palestine exception. This exception has allowed so much of what we've already discussed and heard today to happen. How, in other words, Western governments, officials, mainstream journalists deny and yet paradoxically condone and enable the genocide in Gaza. The Palestine exception works by constantly evoking a very specific and profoundly Eurocentric narrative of anti-Semitism. This narrative displaces Palestinians from history at the same time as Israel displaces Palestinians from their own land. Ideologically, the Palestine exception expels Palestinians from serious ethical or political consideration in the name of reconstituting and defending Western humanity and so-called civilization after the Second World War. The Palestine exception has forced upon the Palestinians the burden of not simply being the victims of the victims, to evoke Edward Said's famous formulation, but the stigma of being a reincarnation of Nazis after Nazism in post-Holocaust Western consciousness, allegedly and putatively cleared of its historic anti-Semitism, to say nothing of an Israeli Jewish consciousness that has predicated its entire colonial project in Palestine on the denial and destruction of Palestinian history, Palestinian memory, and Palestinian archives. Why, in short, across so many parts of the liberal West that so solemnly proclaims the universality of law and enshrines notions of human rights, are Jewish victims of violence valued vastly more than the greater number of Palestinian victims? Most of all, why does the alleged Western concern with combating Western anti-Semitism coincide so clearly with an apparent mainstream Western lack of concern for and disavowal of Palestinian humanity? The question that concerns me, to be clear, is how and why Palestinians and Arabs and Muslims more generally are rendered peoples without history, peoples without ethical or political importance, peoples whose past and therefore whose present and future can be overwritten by a deeply Eurocentric, philo-Zionist narrative. This overriding is one that has valorized for a century, at least, the imperatives of nationalist Zionist ideology in Palestine, that has cherished and celebrated the creation of an exclusively Jewish nationalist state in a multi-religious Palestine, irrespective of the obvious implications such a state has entailed for millions of non-Jewish men, women, and children, in other words, Palestinians, as well as, of course, for Jews themselves. Now, the interesting aspect of this overwriting of Palestinian history, this erasure of Palestinian history, has been the profoundly uneven manner of its transaction over a century and a bit. At first, in the 19th century, if we go back to the 19th century, Palestinians as people were barely seen or considered. Then, with the advent of British-backed colonial Zionism in Palestine, and specifically with the Balfour Declaration of 1917 and then the British Mandate that lasted until 1948, Palestinians were considered, quote, non-Jewish natives, who were very much seen, and because, of course, they were on the ground, to the point where the UN 1947 partition plan openly acknowledged the degree to which partition would harm the Arabs of Palestine. Then, of course, you had the Nakba. Palestinians were forgotten by the liberal West. And finally, when Palestinians have insisted on their history and their future, as well as on their present, they have almost always been demonized as anti-Semitic after the Nakba. So the Zionist project in and over Palestine developed as an openly colonialist project in the 19th century, when European empires routinely segregated humanity into a hierarchy of superior and inferior races. So while leading Zionists grappled with racial anti-Semitism in Europe, they were also desperate to belong to this Europe. They expressed, they shared, they contributed, they circulated many of the foundational racist tropes of 19th century Western culture. That the non-West was manifestly inferior, supposedly. That the lands of indigenous peoples was largely empty and thus open to colonization. That removal of native peoples was both justifiable and necessary. Recall, of course, one of the notorious slogans of the Zionist movement, a land without a people, for a people without a land. And the underlying point here is that both the Christian and Jewish versions of colonial Zionism were predicated on solving Europe's Jewish question, quote-unquote, by removing or restoring Jews en masse to Palestine as if Palestinians did not exist or fundamentally did not matter. Now, this obfuscation was theoretical, as long as Zionism remained ideology in Europe. But once it became colonial practice in Palestine, it became, of course, colonial practice. As soon as Zionism, in other words, moved from Christian and Jewish Western colonial fantasy to Western colonial practice, Muslim and Christian Palestinians inevitably were seen. They were, of course, on their homes, in their lands, in Palestine. As such, they constituted a real impediment to the successful unfolding of colonial Zionism. Native resistance, that is to say, Palestinian resistance, compelled the British colonial rulers to figure out some way to reconcile their commitment to Zionism in Palestine, colonial Zionism, with the reality of Palestinian bodies on the ground. And so, in other words, how do you resolve this sort of impossible situation? The British, in 1937, proposed the partition plan of Palestine, which foreshadowed, that's the Peel Commission plan, which foreshadowed the 1947 UN partition plan. Both plans, the British one and then the UN one, a decade apart, prioritized making of a Jewish state, not the creation of a secular and democratic state. Both embraced as a central idea that the dispossessing of native Palestinians, the majority of the population, from much of its land and its homes, to make way for a Jewish state was both necessary and inevitable. The 1937 British partition plan, in fact, the Peel Plan, admitted openly the injustice to the Palestinian natives who owned the majority of the land of any partition. And with remarkable disingenuousness, the Peel Commission lauded, celebrated, or cited the proverbial, what they call the generosity of the Arabs, to justify what the Peel Commissioner said was at some sacrifice to the Arabs, that this sacrifice would help the Europeans solve what the Commission referred to as the West's, quote, Jewish problem. In other words, the Peel Commissioners were very clear that we see the Palestinians, they're going to suffer, but they're going to help us resolve Europe's Jewish problem. And that is the language of the Peel Commission. A decade later, in November 1947, the Western-dominated UN, of course, this is the UN before decolonization, voted to partition Palestine and to establish a Jewish state and an Arab one, despite the fact that the same UN recognized that the overwhelming majority of the population of Palestine was Palestinian, and despite centuries of Palestinian belonging to what had always been their lands, their villages, their towns, and their homes. Virtually every Western state that voted for partition in 1947 recognized that the Palestinians, the Arabs, existed and that they would be harmed, but they justified their vote by insisting that what happened to the Jews in Europe was a horror, in other words, the Holocaust, was a horror that needed urgent redress. And this redress, they said, embracing Zionist logic, could only occur in Palestine, even if it occurred at the expense of the Palestinians. In other words, this is not so much about overt denial, but about recognizing the harm that was going to be done to Palestinians and then justifying that harm in the name of making amends for the horrors of the Second World War, and of course for solving what was a European Jewish displaced persons problem after the Second World War. So in the wake of the Holocaust and the creation of a new international community that disavowed the overt racism of Nazi Germany, but turned a blind eye to racism, Western racism, across the rest of the West, and of course the colonized world, the narrow Christian philo-Semitism that had sort of informed earlier Western support of Zionism was effaced by a far more practical, secular, liberal, and temporally urgent language of saving Jews and ending what was now referred to in 1947 as the Palestine problem. The irony was that the Arab was at last heard at the UN and seen on the ground in Palestine, but without emotion, without identification, without connection that Jewish diplomats, survivors, and refugees made among Western diplomats. There was nothing the Palestinians or the Arab diplomats at the UN could say, let alone do, that made any appreciable dent in this powerful equivalence between Zionism and the sudden post-war Western desire to be done with its so-called Jewish problem, especially in a manner that satisfied the Zionist movement that claimed to speak on behalf of the Jewish people worldwide. That the Palestinians were to be sacrificed at the altar of Philo-Zionism was acknowledged only obliquely, since virtually every Western representative at the UN insisted that they were cognizant and sympathetic to the aspirations of what they referred to as the Arab inhabitants of Palestine. Nevertheless, they voted, almost all of them, for the UNSCOP proposal, the UN Special Committee on Palestine proposal, that of course destroyed Palestine, destroyed Arab society, and as much as they said they were aware of the problems to Palestinians, they nevertheless voted to harm the Palestinians. And then of course there was a Nakba of 1948, that at least for a while brutally resolved the problem of a majority of Palestinian bodies in a Jewish state that had long preoccupied Zionist planners. It created in turn a humanitarian problem that the liberal Western agencies, UNRWA specifically, have only been too happy to tackle so long as it avoided the obvious history and politics of the question of Palestine. Liberal Western states and leaders, in fact, hailed the creation of an ethno-religious nationalist Jewish state in a historically multi-religious land. Leading American liberal figures such as the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr and the co-author of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Eleanor Roosevelt, rationalized and justified the uprooting of Palestinians. So my point here in conclusion is that the Second World War and the creation of Israel in 1948 reflected far more than just Western settler colonialism as a practice of native elimination, although that was obviously there as well. The support for Israel, I think, is the more important point that I'm trying to make. The identification with Israel, the reconstitution of post-war Western humanism was reborn with a Philo-Zionist core and with a Palestine exception at its heart. In other words, the Western powers after the Second World War claimed to be done with the history of European and Western anti-Semitism by recognizing a Jewish state in Israel, at the same time as they acknowledged initially that there was going to be harm done to the Palestinians. But over time, as Palestinians were made into a refugee people, were made into a stateless people, were made into a people without history, the Palestinians were forgotten. And then what happens is that as they got forgotten, and as this narrative of a European triumph in the Second World War over Nazism was consolidated, what happens is that over time, when Palestinians insist on their history, because they're seen as a people without history, they seem to come in from out of the blue as a people without history, and therefore almost always, and we've heard this over and over again today, depicted as somehow anti-Semitic. And so there we have it until today. That's the that sort of explains to me the kind of the moment that we're in, that no matter what Palestinians say, no matter what they do, until this deeply Eurocentric narrative of one history and only one history that matters is made more universal, until we actually recognize Palestinian history and Palestinian and Palestinian politics, there's very little, I think, to be done to that will break this kind of ideological sort of framework that has so comprehensively excluded Palestinians, expelled Palestinians, as I said, not just from their lands, but from historical consciousness as well in the West, in the mainstream West. Hopefully this is changing with a new generation and with different forms of media, but let's see if that actually happens. Thank you.
Sari Makhdizi speaking at the Gaza Tribunal in Sarajevo late last May. Makhdizi is an American literary critic of Palestinian and Lebanese descent and professor of English and comparative literature at the University of California, Los Angeles. We'll link to Sari Makhdizi at greenplanetmonitor.net and to the Sarajevo Declaration of the Gaza Tribunal. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started, so I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.